case on calendar for argument today is Hotch versus Figgs. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Steve Hubachek, Robin Skeller on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants. Your Honors, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this morning I'd like to devote my time to addressing the negligence and failure to reasonably investigate-based Securities Act claims as to the misleading impression created in the offering documents in the initial public offering and the subsequent one that informed investors that Figgs had advanced data analytics capabilities. And they did that by making statements such as they had the ability to reliably predict buying patterns, that, quote, they had product lifecycle data integration. Those statements were extremely important to the market, as multiple analysts remarked upon them. One, in fact, even said that that was Figgs' biggest competitive advantage, is its digital-only model and superior data collection and analytics.
Counsel, can we start with a threshold question? Should we apply Rule 9b, heightened pleading standards, or Rule 8?
Absolutely not. Rule 8 should apply here. And that was, in fact, one of the two sources of error that I was going to address this morning.
Tell me why, because these Securities Act claims seem to dovetail almost exactly with the Exchange Act ones, other than the fact that one set of allegations are about registration statements and the like from the offering documents, and the others are about a fraudulent course of conduct, but they both rely on this unified course of conduct of, you know, misstating deliberately the data analytics and low inventory risk and the like. I mean, they seem very similar, if not identical, when I look at them side by side. So why shouldn't Rule 9b apply?
Rule 9b should apply because all of the Securities Act claims all allege only negligence and failure to investigate. That's the bottom line. In Dow, this court said basically that we usually apply Rule 9 to Securities Act claims when there's a wholesale adoption of all of the allegations. But there is no such wholesale adoption here. I mean, for instance, in many cases, there will be a Section 11, Section 12 claim based upon offering documents, and then a Section 10b claim based upon the exact same facts. We don't have that here. We have a temporal break, substantial temporal break, and then additional facts that occur as, you know, things progress during the period of time during which the class period runs.
Counsel, so they are different facts. What are the specific allegations regarding negligence?
Your Honor, the negligence allegations are at paragraphs 37, 124, 136, 174, 189, 203, 180, 182, and 195.
Okay, could you summarize that for me? What is the negligence that's alleged?
Well, the negligence is that these statements were made without adequate investigation, without reasonably investigating whether or not they were true. It's just basically standard negligence. There's no obligation for these particular claims that there be a showing of scienter as there is for the later Section 10b claims. And even if we were to decide that, and I don't think that you should, but if you were to decide that Rule 9 should apply, what the district court didn't do is it skipped the next step of that analysis, which is set forth in the Vest decision. And it says that, quote, the only consequence of a holding that Rule 9b is violated with respect to a Section 11 claim would be that any allegations of fraud would be stripped from the claim. That's what Vest says at 317 Fed 3rd at 1105. The district court never identified any allegations of fraud that were applicable to the Section 11, Section 12 claims. But
I guess moving aside from the labels of it, you know, our Rupke case talks about how where a complaint employs the exact same factual allegations to allege violations of Section 11 as it uses to allege fraudulent conduct under Section 10B, we can assume that that sounds in fraud. And when I look at your, because I had my law clerk print this out side by side, and they look almost exactly alike. You know, what the some of the Section 11 claims say are challenge the DTC strategy, giving access to valuable real-time customer data that allows us to better acquire and retain customers and reliably predict buying patterns. And then for the Exchange Act claims, you know, paragraph 252, DTC strategy also gives us access to valuable real-time customer data that we leverage in all aspects of our business, demand forecasting and inventory optimization leading to operational efficiencies. They just really seem to dovetail into the same theory of harm, basically, from both of these things.
Well, the theory of harm basically is that the statements are misleading. But the fact that a statement is misleading isn't enough to suggest that it's fraudulent. This court's recent decision in Funko made a distinction between the fact that you have falsity on the one hand, which doesn't involve what's actually in the defendant's head, and then you have fraud on the other hand, which does involve what's in the defendant's head. The same point was made in the Refco decision that we cited in the opening brief that explains that you can't simply conflate falsity and scienter. And in this case, we allege only falsity as to those statements. Yeah, I'm not going to deny that the statements are similar. Your Honor certainly is correct about that. But there is no allegation that there was any sort of scienter with respect to the earlier statements that are made in 2021. You know, by the time...
I mean, you don't need scienter for Rule 9b, though. That's just under the PSLRA.
Right, but the point is that the idea is that we're talking about applying Rule 9b because this claim supposedly sounds in fraud. But there is
no fraud. Let me ask you this: I was having a hard time understanding what are the actually false statements that you were alleging for the Securities Act claims? Is it that FIGS did not have a data analytics system? Or is it that it had one, but it was an unsophisticated one? Or was it that it has one, but it wasn't proprietary because it borrowed from others? I was having a bit of a hard time understanding what exactly is the falsehood that's being alleged.
Well, the falsehood that's being alleged is whatever it was that FIGS had, its complement of data analytics capabilities did not meet the standard of what they
but,
were.
But which, I gave you three categories. Which of those three are you asserting it was the false statement? I think I've covered them all. Maybe I'm missing one, but.
I understand what Your Honor's point is. I guess what I'm trying to say is that the point that we're trying to make is they claimed certain attributes. Whatever system it was that they had did not have those attributes. And we have witnesses that have come forward and said that. They said that they never had sophisticated data analytics. One of the witnesses came forward and said that it's laughable to suggest that they could, that they had data, integrated product lifecycle data, and that they could use that information in order to make accurate predictions as to their demand. So whatever their system...
Taking that statement, then it was an unsophisticated system, even though FIGS represented that it was a sophisticated system.
Yes, and certainly, you know, we've used the PLM type system as an example. It didn't meet the standard of the PLM system. In fact, both of the witnesses said that was essential for this type of company with the type of products that they were selling and manufacturing and transporting across.
I mean, FIGS never uses the word PLM in its offering statements.
No,
but you were using it throughout your briefing, so. Why would it be false for FIGS to have not used PLM?
Well, we're not saying that it's false for not having used PLM.
Okay.
What we're saying is that that's basically an example of what the gold standard is. They claimed that they had a system that allowed them to replicate those types of functions. We're not saying that they ever used the word PLM, that they said that they had a PLM. We're using that as basically as a yardstick. And, you know, the two witnesses that we have both say that that is eventually the gold standard as to this type of company.
So CW1 was hired after the class period, and the district court discounted the reliability of CW1's statements because how could that witness testify to statements being made in public or offering statements when that witness wasn't around? What's wrong with that?
I think that the error there is that the district court sort of read Zucco as creating a per se rule that if you're not employed at the time of the facts that you're relating, that your information cannot be considered. But that's not what Zucco said. I mean, Zucco was talking about two witnesses, one of whom, and it was a financial case, an accounting case. One of those witnesses who didn't work at the right period of time was in human resources, so knew nothing firsthand about any of the facts that were related. The other witness discussed in Zucco was for a short period of time in the right place, but offered nothing other than the anonymous hearsay statements. So again, no personal knowledge. CW1, however, was in the IT department. CW1 was responsible for integrating the various data systems that FIGS had, so necessarily had responsibilities to put together the legacy systems and the current systems, because demand planning, as it currently exists, requires both that you integrate your historical data and your current data in order to figure out how much you should order, how much you should sell, how much you should manufacture. So that witness's actual responsibilities required knowledge of the previous situation. The other factor I think that supports the credibility of CW1 as to those facts is that we're not talking about, you know, what was being discussed around the water cooler, you know, in some period of time when you didn't work there. We're talking about systems that were in place. There's no reason to believe that the systems in place in 2023 when CW1 started would be worse than what they had in 2021. In fact, in 2022, they added for the first time a PLM, which, you know, never was actually adequately utilized or staffed. But there's no reason to believe that the systems that were in place in 2021 were better than in 2023. And in fact, as I mentioned, CW1 had every incentive to go back and determine what was in place then.
Is it a problem that we're talking almost about a subjective opinion as to how sophisticated a system is? And I understood CW1 was saying, look, this is basic. And part of my impression from reading your briefing was that it seemed as if the argument was being made that modern apparel companies should operate in a certain way and should have this PLM system and be sophisticated and do all these things. And FIGS wasn't doing it. But the district court, I think, faulted some of the witnesses, including CW2, for really, presenting statements that were more in the range of opinion or subjective evaluation or lacking personal knowledge. Why should CW1 representation that this is not a sophisticated enough system prove falsity of the statements?
Well, CW1 and CW2 both said that they didn't have the capacity to make these types of predictions. You know, they were constantly, you know, playing catch up, trying to respond to changing situations. So it's not just that you should have had a grade A system, but you only had a C. It's about whether or not they had the ability to do the things that they said they were able to do, particularly their claim that they had the ability to predict their demand accurately. And CW1 and CW2 established that. You know, I think CW2's allegations were also improperly discredited because CW2 worked in product development. But product development is directly impacted by the types of systems that we're talking about. And if you look at, I think it's paragraph 143, the defendant said demographic, geographic, and psychographic data enables FIGS to reliably predict buying patterns, leading to operational efficiencies throughout our supply chain, inventory management, and new product development. So product developers are touched by these systems. That product developer was in a position to know these types of facts. You know, product developers also deal directly with the factory, and so CW2 would know that there weren't systems in place that allowed the factory to access FIGS's data, as would be the case with modern demand planning under a PLM. CW2 also had significant personal knowledge, having attended those big final meetings and seen all of the various changes in direction that took place at the last minute, changes in style, cancellations, and reported that those began before the IPO and intensified after the IPO. So both of those witnesses provide important information. One of the other things that's important in Zucco is corroboration. The two witnesses corroborate each other. They both say that a PLM is important. They both say that the PLM system that FIGS ultimately put into effect was deficient and inadequately staffed. They both say they lacked significant data analytics abilities. They both say that there was a catastrophic workflow. And they both say that at FIGS, they were actually using manual demand planning with documents that were local documents created from Google and Microsoft. So everything that Zucco asks for, whether or not there's a coherent, plausible narrative in which you can satisfy the standard of probability that these people were probably in a position to know these facts, I think we've satisfied those, and I think they demonstrate that the facts are mistaken. I see that I've run out of time.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is it afternoon yet? Good afternoon, Koji Fukumura.
We have 4 minutes till afternoon.
Well, good morning then. On behalf of the FIGS and underwriter defendant, Appalese. I know we had said that we're going to take 11 minutes and 4 minutes, but Councilor Telco just said that since there was nothing addressed to them that I could take, that they just want to reserve 1 minute, so I'll take 14 minutes. Let me go right to this negligence claim. So let me start off by saying he only addressed really Section 11. So we have to focus on the time period, right? And because, of course, Section 11, Section 12 claims, they depend on the effective date of the registration statement in the prospectus. And I'll just throw those time periods out for you right now. The effective date of the IPO registration statement is May 26, 2021. And of the secondary public offering, that is September the 15th, 2021. So my friend talked about what he describes as a complete absence of demand planning. And he talked about a PLM, which they never describe really after a couple of complaints, they never describe what a PLM really is. And so you have this sort of ambiguous term, and we pointed out in Cloudera that if you're going to use a term like that, you have to define it in the complaint, and you really have to put some meat into it. But I'll come back to a PLM in a second, because that's not, as Your Honor pointed out, that's not what the company talked about. They never used the word PLM, and in fact, my friend conceded that the company didn't even purchase a PLM, whatever it does, until February 2022, which is almost a year after the IPO and 9 months after the SPO. What FIGS told investors in the registration statement was that as a direct-to-consumer company, it was trying to distinguish itself from its competitors. All of its competitors sold to distributors, and those distributors in turn sold to retailers, brick-and-mortar companies, and then so they didn't know their customers. So what FIGS did at the very beginning in the section titled Who We Are, they described who they are, which is that they're a digitally native company, that they sell products directly to end users, to consumers, that they know their customers. And these, they sell it through their website, enabled or integrated with Shopify, and that with Shopify, FIGS has access to a treasure trove of information. Performance and sales metrics. They know what the hypothetical nurse Smith wears, what size she wears, what color she prefers, what's her average order volume. Does she buy just scrubs, or when she visits, does she buy limited edition styles or colors or non-core products? Does she access, importantly, the website and purchase in response to a text message, an email, a new product launch? All of that information, they don't deny Shopify provides. So if you think of that treasure trove of information, and my friend belittles the use of Excel, but Shopify administration will download all of that information in something called CSV files, which are Excel files. And Excel, in turn, can analyze all that data, make pivot tables based on what's selling, what's not, you know, when people are buying, when they're not, what colors people like, what colors people don't like. So did we have data? Yeah. Did we have a treasure trove of data? Did that help in demand planning? Obviously. They haven't pointed to anything that a PLM does. And let me just pause right here and think about this for a moment. This company has been around since 2013. In 2020, the year before the IPO, it had 1.1 million customers. It had 163 million in revenue. By the end of 2021, it had 1.9 million customers. They talk about a catastrophe and nothing happening. Well, lots of stuff was happening. We were selling an increasing amount of goods. My client was selling an increasing amount of goods. Revenue was doubling between 2018 and 2019 by 110%. Between 2019 and 2020, 140%, and it goes on. So I don't understand where they've pointed to specific facts showing that there was an inability to meet demand or to understand all these analytics that the company was getting from Shopify.
So just to understand, so Figs, in your view, has the data analytics through Shopify and through other means. But what about CW1's contention that this is basic and ad hoc? And, you know, I did pose the question, you know, he is hired after the class period, but there is a fair point to be made. How would it be that the company would have a sophisticated system in 21 and 22 and then not have one in 2023? So why shouldn't there be some evidence or allegations to support that this was not a sophisticated data analytics system and so therefore Figs was making false statements in its offering documents?
Where is there a well-pled fact that a PLM is a data analytics system? The reason why, and so this is critical, they had a chance to amend their complaint. The judge dismissed their Section 11 claims without prejudice, and they chose instead to seek a judgment and come before this court. So what is a PLM? Well, we have a little bit of an idea, given the allegations that are in there, review of CW1's, she talks about color libraries and raw materials and purchase order information. CW2 talks about a tech pack to include a bill of materials, sketches, designs. So we get an idea. I know what a PLM is, and they don't describe it with any, and perhaps they don't because had they described it accurately, it wouldn't jibe with their allegations. A PLM is really on the front end. What CW2 would do would take a tech pack, get drawings from designers, and make an order. So all of the PLM functions are on the front end, ordering color and color dyes, ordering materials, and or ordering complete clothes. But it doesn't tell you about the back end, which is what the demand issue is. These data analytics are coming out on macro level. How are things selling, and how do we know that? Well, we get it from Shopify. Right? As I started out by saying, Shopify has this enormous amount of data, not only at a macro level about how many, Cade jogger shorts jogger pants we sold, but in what colors and in response to what stimulus. Was it something on Instagram? Was it on Facebook? Was it a TV ad? So all of this information has nothing to do with the PLM, which is sort of an order entry system to buy goods. Again, if this is not clear, it's not our fault. I could tell you all about a centric system, and what they call basic is core, and it's really just about the front end of how companies go about manufacturing goods.
How much does this turn on applying Rule 8 versus Rule 9B?
It doesn't at all.
But do you think we should apply Rule 9B or no?
I think Your Honor pointed out, and Your Honor pointed out one half of the problem that they face. We put in as from SCR, two figs SCR 455 to two SCR 466, a side-by-side chart of the statements they allege to be false. And as Your Honor pointed out, they look remarkably the same. The bigger problem for them is not that they challenge the same type of statements. It's the reasons why they're false. That's where we see a mirror, right? So if you think about from a fraud perspective, that statement is false because CW2 said that there were chaotic last-minute changes made, and you know, Heather and Trina, the co-CEOs, imposed their own personal taste. By the way, that they should, they made the company, but imposed their own personal taste and changed things. Those are the same allegations in both the Exchange Act claims and the Securities Act claims. So it's not only the fact that similar statements are alleged to be false, but the reasons why they're false are the same. And that is, that's, so yes, 9B should apply. But the court applied Rule 8 for many of the defendants, and we agree that the court got that wrong too. So why is that? So let me talk a little bit more about CW1, because it's not only that there's this temporal disconnect, but when she says that she looked at the PLM system, what she doesn't say is, I looked at historical data. She talked about Excel. She talked about Google Docs. She never said she looked at any of those documents, because those, if in fact that's where this analysis occurs, this treasure trove of information that's sorted into pivot tables and tells you about, you know, consumer behavior, behavior metrics, you know, psychographic information about what Koji likes to wear, what Nurse Smith likes to wear, or how people respond to certain type of ads. CW1 doesn't say anything about that, or that that was ineffective, and therefore these statements are false. She never says that she looked at any 2021 era data or anything that's really sort of relevant to what we've been describing here.
Counsel, did the district court erect a per se rule that if a CW is outside of the time period, that the CW is per se unreliable?
I don't think so. I think the district court was looking at this factual scenario. The plaintiffs cite Quality Systems, and they didn't argue it, but Quality Systems is something they rely on to say that there's no per se rule. Look at, you know, CW6, the court relied so much on CW6 and Quality Systems. Well, in Quality Systems, CW6 was a former director of the company. He was then became the chief operating officer of the company. He's someone who said, I personally looked at Salesforce. I saw that there was a shift away from these big licensing deals, which had been driving revenue for that company. And CW6, I came to the conclusion that the market was saturated. Now, these new big licensing deals were the whole point of the trajectory of the stock of that company. He leaves, yes, but his particular statements are corroborated by CW5, who says, yeah, I actually made the reports that showed that these greenfield opportunities were going away and we were going to a recurring model. And importantly, CW2 was the chief information officer of the company, also corroborated CW6, who had left, and said, I was on an internal conference call with the CEO when he admitted that the market had become saturated for these big new licensing deals. So it's a very different situation. We have to look at what CW1 said, what CW2 said, and how that affects, you know, what is she talking about in particular? It's almost like speculation. And speaking of speculation, let's talk a little bit about CW2. The district court correctly said that most of her statements were hearsay. She said, I recall being told, right? I remember someone saying to me that. The only time she has a personal interaction is she said she sat in on big meetings where, you know, Heather or Trina changed their mind about something or, you know, brought in their dress or, you know, these anecdotal statements. One thing she doesn't do, and I asked you to focus on the time period in the beginning, she doesn't ever say when. She started in 2020. She left in 2022. What product did this relate to? What quarter did it relate to? How does this render anything that the company said misleading? How does that relate in any way to demand planning? And by the way, I see my time is up. What these plaintiffs do is that they ignore the entirety of the pandemic during the macroeconomic pressures, but I'll go back to say that during 2021, you know, not only did you have the port closures, the third and fourth largest. All right.
Thank you, counsel. Yeah. 1 minute. We have 1 minute here first before your minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Reza Rashid on behalf of Tolko LLC. Tolko barely appears in the First Amendment complaint. It hasn't come up in argument today, and the plaintiffs don't actually allege that it did anything wrong. Instead, the theory against Tolko is that they've offered a variety of legal reasons why Tolko should be responsible for any alleged misstatements that were in these offering documents. We agree with Mr. Fukumura that there aren't any misstatements and the claims otherwise fail against FIGS, which is sufficient to dispose of the case against all defendants. Did want to point out very quickly, though, that even if that were not the case, the plaintiffs still don't have any claim against Tolko. All the security statutes at issue in this case carefully specify classes of defendants who can potentially be liable. Large investors like Tolko aren't on the list. The federal securities laws have been around since the 1930s, and courts have not embraced a rule essentially importing this automatic per se liability for investors, and for good reason. It contradicts the statutory text, as we explain in our briefing. Essentially, what the plaintiffs have done in this case is they have alleged a handful of facts against Tolko that are common to all big investors, had a large stock ownership, it had the right to appoint one seat on the board. They've said, okay, well, that's enough to satisfy any number of legal theories they posited for Tolko's liability. The problem with that is essentially you would be rewriting the securities laws nearly 100 years later because those facts are true of all big investors.
All right, counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're here on a 12B6 motion, so we are limited to the complaint, not to, my friend's description of the Shotify uses. I would point out that with respect to CW2, we specifically, in our part of the argument, emphasized the points that CW2 had specific knowledge of. You know, there's a claim that CW2 wasn't specific as to time, but in fact, CW2 said that these meetings where there were constant last-minute changes began before the IPO and intensified after. So there is a temporal element there. With respect to CW1 and paragraph 22, he or she basically says all the things that they claimed they were doing, they weren't actually able to accomplish. And then lastly, this is not a Cloudera Tesla situation where we're asking for our own idiosyncratic definition of PLM. It's actually in the complaint 94, but we're not saying that they said they had a PLM. We're saying that they could not do the things that they said that they could do. And the fact that the founders may want to change their designs at the last minute is entirely up to them. They just can't tell people they're relying on data rather than their own choices.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to all counsel for your helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. That completes our calendar for today. We are in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All rise.